So, hey, good morning. My name is Ben. I'm a pastor here at Midtown 12 South. We're glad you're here with us at our 11 a.m. service. We are marching through the book of John kind of this spring, summer, and fall, and we're kind of dropping the RPMs, going very, very slow. We're actually obeying the speed limit of Jesus, which is slow. And we're really marching through and seeing what is John trying to tell us about who Jesus is. He's this gospel writer, John is, and he kind of does something different than the other three gospels. Those are called synoptic, meaning the same optics, the same lens, the same viewpoint. And John says, hold my drink, like, I'm going to do something different here. And so he writes a totally different kind of viewpoint on who Jesus is. And kind of one theme and one thread throughout all of John is this, that Jesus is a Messiah. But he's a Messiah. He's come to save and liberate and free and empower his people in a way that he is misunderstood. And he's a misunderstood Messiah, and all throughout John, he has come to and with and for his people, and they don't get him. Like, the ideals that he has and the plans he has and the workings that he has can't fit into their little brains and them being us. And actually, it's very validating to kind of Jesus working in our life, because there's oftentimes he works and we can't understand what he's doing. We can't make sense of this Jesus that's coming and giving us life and what that life is looking like as he's doing it. And so we're looking at this misunderstood Messiah. And this morning we're in chapter 11 of John. If you have a Bible, you can open it. It's on the screen. That will kind of pick pieces of it throughout this kind of 40 some odd verses. But John 11 talks about the raising of Lazarus. He's risen from the dead. Spoiler alert, if you didn't know that. But a bulk of the passage is actually really not about Lazarus at all. In fact, Jesus and Lazarus don't really have a conversation ever. Most of the passage, if not all the passage, is about those who grieve because of the loss. Jesus is talking to grievers in this story, and that's why this morning we see this kind of misunderstood Messiah theme applied to John 11. It's this. There's a misunderstood grief that Jesus is wading into and offering as he meets those who grieve. And so for us to discover what grief is, and he's dealing with grief, what is grief? It's important we get our arms around what grief is. And when you hear the topic of grief, the word of grief, you can, some of you kind of instantaneously within a millisecond of a moment can know, I know grief because of this. Like, this thing, this event, this person, I know grief because of this. It's very clear. In fact, it's actually informing so much of you because it's such a weighty part of your story. And for others, it's kind of like, it's very different. Like when someone walks into a hospital after like being kind of sick for a number of months and they're saying, doctor, I'm sick. And they'd say, no, you're pregnant. Like, there's something happening in you that you don't even know about. And actually there's something being birthed in you that you don't even know about and can't make sense of. So whether you are someone who knows in the instant moment, here's how I'm grieving, or I don't know what's happening in me, and I actually need someone else to look at this with me, what I'd offer you this morning is we're all grievers. And we're all grievers because we're all lovers. And we're all lovers because we all live. That to live is to love, and to love is to, when you lose, is to grieve. And all of you have lost something because all of you love something. So the question is, for you, what have you loved and what have you lost? If you want to figure out what is something I'm grieving in life and kind of to have this passage applied to it, what is something that you have loved and that you have lost? There's an artist, Stephen Wilson Jr., and if you haven't listened to him, I'm grieving that right now in front of you. But grief marks so much of his songs, so much of his songwriting. It's kind of this thread and this ingredient that you see in each and every words that he writes. But one song in particular, it's called Grief Is Only Love. And his thesis, his premise really does apply to this and applies to us. And it's this kind of word and phrase that he says over and over and over again. And it's that grief is only love that's got no place to go. That grief is only love that's got no place to go. Meaning you're a lover and you found a connection and an attachment and you've given yourself to something and that thing is gone. That someone is gone. That place is gone. And now that love is still there though. And it can't find a resting place to go. And so you're holding this love that you had for something that you no longer have. And grief is only love that has no place to go. And so if we begin to kind of apply that and with that definition of grief in our lives, and our stories, you can see how there's an ability for grief to mark so many parts of our lives. Now, for Martha and for Mary in this story, grief, and maybe this is for you, it's because you've lost someone, that death has kind of come and taken someone from you that you loved and you had and you don't have anymore. For others, maybe it's different. Maybe it's plans. You had plans for your life and you came attached to it and you loved it and you, like Tommy Boy, like you pet it and you love it and it's gone. It's torn apart because this architecture of the plans you had for life aren't there anymore and you've lost them. You had dreams in life, and really when I say dreams, I mean you had the ability to dream, and the hard knocks of life have kind of beat the dreaming out of you. You don't know how to be a dreamer anymore because life has been so hard in the school of hard knocks. You could grieve because you've loved the season of life, that you had something so precious and personal and kind of priceless, and that's no longer there. You could grieve an innocence you had because you've had to grow up too fast because of the things that have happened to you or in you and around you. You could grieve ability. Like you aren't Uncle Rico, like you aren't as good as you used to be. Like your get up and go got up and went. Like you can't live life as you once did. You can grieve that. You can grieve not having courage anymore. You used to be able to live courageously and you don't have it anymore, it's gone. Fear and distrust are there. You understand that. Grief can be applied really to just about any category in life because the heart goes to so many categories in life and declares and attaches its love to something. And so often on this side of eternity, loss can mark those categories of life. And so as we start this morning, it's kind of like the beginning of a movie where it says kind of viewer discretion advised, or these topics are going to be at play. And I want to say that to you, because you're all lovers, because you live, and you lose, and therefore you grieve. And so whatever that looks like to take care of yourself this morning, I'm not here to say sit down and listen to this. I'm also not saying hit the eject button either. But I am giving you full permission to do as you see fit with the weight that you're carrying of grief as we look at a passage that really does speak to grief. So you have the freedom to get up and walk out whenever. You will not offend me. In fact, I'll commend you for the courage. And a part of that is because wrestling with this topic this week and this passage this week, this is not a faceless idea. Like when you begin to have rubber hit the road for this, I know you guys, and I know your stories, I know your pains, I know your losses, I know your griefs. And in some ways it felt like, how could this be true? And yet that's the point, is we need to get near this truth to have us begin to hope again. Because that's what Jesus offers us in John 11. In fact, the story for this is the story for us. And here's what we're gonna look at this morning. The simple idea that in our grief, Jesus wants to bring hope where hopelessness reigns. That Jesus wants to bring hope where hopelessness reigns. Death happens to Lazarus, yes. Grieving happens in his sisters, yes. But actually, there's something deeper going on underneath the surface, and it's this. They have lost the ability to hope. And Jesus is here to reinstill hope where hope has been lost. So, let me pray for us. As we begin this morning, launched into John 11. And again, if you want to slip out, slip. King Jesus, 1 Corinthians 15 does say that if we only have hope in this life because Jesus has not risen from the dead, then we are to be pitied. Lord, oftentimes the pain in our life feels like we are to be pitied. The runway runs out of how to even move forward in life. Lord, the ability to even discover and think and see past our own pain and grief because the fog is so thick. And so this very day, Jesus, you have not promised to lift the fog, but what you have promised to do is to meet us in the fog. So be Emmanuel to us now. Be God with us. So the Jesus that we see in John 11 will be the Jesus we see in our lives in 2026 in this room. Do much because you said you promised to do that. Pray Christ in your name. Amen. So we see in John 11, there's kind of these three characters. There's Martha and there's Mary. They're sisters. little sister-sister action. And so there's Lazarus. So this group of siblings of Martha, Mary, and Lazarus are these supporters of Jesus. They're friends of Jesus. They know Jesus. And in fact, when Jesus has kind of in previous passage chapters, he's been with Martha and Mary in their town. And he's gone and kind of continued his ministry elsewhere. And we see John 11 start in the first verses, and it tells us, hey, Martha and Mary, the sisters, have sent for Jesus because their brother Lazarus is sick. Lazarus is dying. Lazarus is on his deathbed, and they think to themselves, we have to get Jesus here. They believe if Jesus is here, everything will be okay. If we can just get him here, send for our friend Jesus. We've seen him heal. We know him. We love him. And we believe he loves us. I'm crying out to you, Jesus, come and meet me and heal this now. Do much, because if you do, if you come, everything will be okay. Here's what we see in verse 4. After this runner was sent from Martha and Mary to Jesus saying, Lazarus is sick, here's what we see. Verse 4. But when Jesus heard it, the news that Lazarus was sick and dying, he said, this illness does not lead to death, for it is the glory of God. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Verse 4 and 5 tells us, hey, Lazarus is sick, but guess what? Jesus is saying, everything's going to be okay. Like, actually, it's good that he's sick, because guess what? God's glory is going to shine through that. Everything's going to be okay. God's going to win this story. And actually, it says in verse 5, John slips in there, and guess what? It's very clear how he feels. He loves Martha, he loves Mary, and he loves Lazarus. I mean, this is a Cinderella story from the get-go. Sick, he loves them, everything will be okay. Now, in his love for his friends, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, what does the mark and the action and the movement of love do in this story? Here's what Jesus does in this story. Hearing the news that his friends that he loved is sick, here's what he does. It says in verse 6, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Hey, I hear you're sick, and you want me to come to you and fix this problem, and I love you, and I'm going to stay here. I'm going to remain where I am. Actually, I'm not going to come there right now when you have called me to come. What does Jesus do? He does nothing. I hear you need me. I hear that you, I know that you love me. And guess what? I'm actually going to hang out for 2 more days. Like this ability to see this kind of play out and think, it feels like Jesus is elongating their suffering, elongating their grief. And if we do the math in the story that we find out in a few verses, actually, right after the runner left Martha and Mary and went to Jesus, right after that runner left, Lazarus died. So by the time the runner took the 1 day journey from Martha and Mary to Jesus, Lazarus had been dead for 1 day. And if we do more math, it says Jesus stayed where he was for 2 more days. So that means Lazarus was in the tomb for day 2 and day 3. And finally, on the start of day 4, Jesus wakes up and he says, okay, it's time to go. And they take the 1 day journey from where Jesus was all the way down to where Martha and Mary are. And Jesus waits 4 days to go when it could have been half that. So in our modern ears, we hear that and we think to ourselves, okay, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, Jesus. I'm very confused. Like, that does not make any sense. You sat on information that you had and did nothing about when you could have done something. Every person that we know in our modern day that does that is a villain. That's giving Jesus the benefit of the doubt. But what about not giving him the benefit of the doubt? That he knew he could have gone, and all of a sudden, I'm not confused, I'm angry. Like, I'm frustrated and furious that you would have sat on this on this information and not come and saved your friend. It said you loved him and you did nothing? That's our modern kind of interpretation. What about their interpretation though? Because we have to get this, because there's a piece of this that's so important. Actually, in the ancient Near East and Jewish tradition, when someone died, there was still hope. Because actually, for 3 days after that person died, the spirit would hover over the body, waiting and waiting and waiting. And then those 3 days, the spirit hovering over the body before the body began to break down, there was the belief that maybe, like hope against hope, maybe they'll be able to recover. Maybe they'll become alive again. Maybe a miracle will happen. On days 1, 2, 3 of death, there's still hope. But on day 4, hope is gone and left the station. What day did Jesus show up at the tomb of Lazarus? Day 4. Jesus showed up at the tomb of Lazarus to someone he loved and was called for by people that he loved on a day where hope had no business. Hopelessness had left the building. The train had left the station. There was no way for Jesus to do any good work then because there was no way for good to come of the situation. On the 4th day, the person was too far gone, and Jesus shows up on the day where he's too far gone. And for Martha and Mary, they trusted Jesus. They cried out for Jesus. They sent for Jesus. They waited for Jesus. Maybe he'll come today. And Lazarus died. Maybe he'll come. You know what? There's this 3-day thing, like of the spirit hovering. Maybe he'll come on day 1 of the spirit hovering over his body. Okay, well, today, maybe the next day. Maybe day 2 is our day and nothing. And maybe, I'll tell you what, there's one more day. Maybe this is it. Maybe we're just waiting. He's waiting and waiting for us to come to us on day 3. Maybe like the 9th hour, he will come here. He doesn't come. So if you've waited and trusted and hoped for Jesus to come and you've got nothing, what does it feel like? Like what is Martha and Mary, what's going on inside of them after waiting and waiting and trusting and trusting and longing and longing and hoping and hoping? It's awfully lonely. It's awfully lonely to want something so badly and actually cast every bit of your kind of hope bucket and emptying it on this one person and one thing and one potential outcome, and you come up short. It's pretty lonely. Because you've gone all in on the table with the cards that you've been dealt. And actually, there's a spiritual sepsis that begins when hopelessness sets in because your grief has made you lonely. In fact, where you are most lonely, oftentimes, it's where hopelessness reigns. Nicholas Wolterstorff, who's a philosopher and scholar, and he was a professor at Yale years and years ago, among other places. And he kind of was this theological professor, but in his son, who was in his 20s, went to a backpacking trip in Europe, and he didn't come back. On the trip, he died. And so all of a sudden, he's written this book as he's kind of going through all of this knowledge that I have, that I teach in the classroom, and that I even teach in my own heart. I've got to all of a sudden have it seep into me in such a new way because of this new category of grief that I have of losing a son. And he writes a book. I commend it to anybody and everybody. It's called A Lament for a Son. And he's kind of walking through and parsing out everything that what he's feeling and walking through and wading through of his own grief. And here's what he says in that book. Here's one piece and one excerpt. He says this. Nicholas Wolterstorff says, I have been daily grateful for the friend who remarked this. I'm grateful for this truth. Here's the truth that he's grateful for amid his grief. It's that grief isolates. In his grief, he feels more understood by the reality of acknowledging grief isolates. Here's what he says. No matter who else is mourning, you're in your own little cell. Even when people try to comfort you, you're aware that now there's a barrier between you and them made of the horrible thing that happened that keeps you isolated. Grief for Wolterstorff, grief for Martha and Mary, and I would surmise grief for you is marked by isolation because hopelessness really does feel like it's the bread that I eat every morning. You've carried it for days or weeks, but probably months and years, probably even decades. You feel so misunderstood in your grief, and you feel so alone in your grief because there's something that separates you from the world around you. There's that thing. And how in the world could hope be in and around or for that thing? And we see the story of Jesus waiting and not doing anything and arriving on the day that symbolized hopelessness. I bet for you, you've waited and hoped. Maybe in your own grief, Jesus, it feels like he is waiting and waiting and waiting to come to you on the day of hopelessness, though. And while John 11 has a part of this story that really does want us to have the human experience be normalized of the weight and the freight of grief being marked with isolation and loneliness, while it wants to kind of normalize that in a way of that's what it means to be have flesh and bone, what John 11 also really, really wants us to grab hold of is this. It wants us to give a vision for God's timing in our grief. It wants to give a vision for God's timing in your grief. We just sang it. You're sovereign over us, that you're working in our waiting, you're sanctifying us, you're teaching me to trust, you haven't forgotten me, you're sovereign over us. And when you are alone in your grief, those are hard-fought words. And just as the why of suffering and loss and grief are heavy and weighty and hard to answer, and yet just as the why finds the answer in Jesus, the often overlooked question of the when of suffering and the when of loss and the when of grief also finds its answer in the person of Jesus, like we see here. That in your waiting and your wanting and your hoping, as you're there kind of sequentially living into your story, that Jesus is in the detail even of timing, especially when it seems like he's not. I'm not here to make sense of all your suffering, but I am here to tell you there's one that makes sense of the when and the timing of it, even as you carry a love that has been lost. Because actually what John 11 wants us to show us is this, that if he really did love Martha and Mary and Lazarus, and he really did actually wait, that maybe loving and waiting are actually not diametrically opposed, but actually in the economy of Jesus loving us to life, actually what if loving and waiting actually are when his work is most optimized? And actually, we need to know that because it's in the place of suffering that he actually begins to move toward us even after our waiting. That the win of suffering and the win of waiting will know an end because at some point we know he will come right next to us, even in the fog of grief. So how do we see that play? How do we see him move toward Martha and Mary in this story? Because actually we in our suffering and our grief and our loss need to know that. How is he moving toward these, his friends that he loves? And Jesus is remarkably inefficient. Because we know the solution. We know efficiency. He goes from where he was to the tomb of Lazarus, little abracadabra, and he walks out. That's it. Like, just do that, Jesus, and everything will be okay. We know the answer and a solution to the problem of this story, and we probably have a solution to the problem of our story, to the pain of our story, the loss of our story. He's remarkably inefficient. And yet, he's redemptively effective. Because it's not where he goes that's so powerful in the story, it's who he goes to. Who does he go to? He goes to Martha and he goes to Mary long before he answers the problem of the death of Lazarus. So what does he do with Martha and Mary? First, what do we see in Martha? Verse 17, we'll kind of go through these verses of seeing this vignette of Jesus and Martha. It says this. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days, the day of hopelessness. And Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come from Jerusalem to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. But Mary remained in the house. And Martha said to Jesus, who she'd gone out and met Jesus as he's coming in, Lord, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God who has come, is coming into the world. What is Martha holding on to? What does this exchange with Jesus show? That inner grief that she's kind of white knuckling. And it's this Christianese consolation. The thing that Martha is holding on to is this kind of Christianese consolation. And here's what that is. Actually, her theology is kind of half-baked because here's what she's believing. Yes, Jesus, if you were here, he would still be alive. But I know, like, that's a big but. Buts are always big when we kind of make our feelings small. But I know he'll rise again. Like, I know one day he'll rise again. And actually, that day is not today. I know the resurrection, the last day. He will rise again then. There's no way, though, anything good can happen right now. There's this Christianese consolation of resurrection hope is out there. It's not here. Now, there's this way in which, how could hope be here? Hope's left the building. And therefore, the balm that Martha's grief needs from Jesus is this, that your hope is not a future event. Your hope is a present person. That the thing that Jesus gives Martha and what she most needs right then and there is the reality that, yes, he will rise in the last day, but guess what? I'm here and I am the resurrection and life. That life comes from me, life comes through me, life comes because of me. And the ability that Jesus has to meet her in her grief is reminding her of the truth that she most needs, which is this, you're looking at it. That hope isn't far out over there like you might kind of settle for. Hope is right in front of you because I'm right here in front of you. That to get near Jesus and the person of Jesus and the presence of Jesus is to be near the resurrection and the life. Jesus knew her enough to know in her grief, she needs to know something. And she needs to know this, I am the resurrection and the life. Not way off there, but right here. It's me. So what does her sister need? If Martha needs to know this kind of, not this theological truth that's way out there, but a present person who's right there in front of her that she can touch and embrace as this person is touching and embracing her, what does her sister need? What does Mary need? Look in verse 28. It says this. It said, when she, Martha, had said this to Jesus, like, I believe you, you are the Son of God. Martha, she, went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village. He's still outside the village where he talked, still in the place that he and Mary had met. Verse 31, when the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise up quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died. And when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews that had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and greatly troubled. He said, where have you laid him? And they said, Lord, come and see. In John 11, verse 35, Jesus wept. What's Mary like? Mary's a puddle. Mary's a mess. That she has this faint spirit. There's not even an ability to converse with Jesus. All that she says to Jesus is the same words that her sister had said to Jesus, which is this, if you were here, my brother would not have died. And does she, even saying the same thing to her Savior, does she get the same solution and the same balm that her sister got? No, because Jesus knows she can't handle truth right now. She doesn't need truth right now. In verse 33, it says this word, that he's moved in his spirit, that there's something happening inside of him. And it's not this simply, I feel for you. I'm moving towards you. T's and P's, you know, like, love you. What moved in spirit actually means is this. It's like when an animal snorts and like makes a visceral defensive and offensive reaction to something that is threatening it. It's this kind of bristling and flaring up with indignation to the point in which you're going to act upon your indignation. And what do we see, how do we translate that to grief? Is that Jesus is looking at the thing that is making his beloved friend Mary weep. And he's furious about it. There's an indignation that he feels about the thing in which it has stolen hope from his sweet sister in such a way that he actually, before he fixes it, he's furious at it. And what is he toward her? He's tender. Jesus can't contain his displeasure with death and see how it robs Mary. And here's the balm that Mary's grief received. Jesus, you are moved by what moves me. And only in Jesus could he weep with you, even right before he's going to change the thing that makes you weep. Mary and Martha said the same thing to Jesus. Lord, if you would have been here, my brother wouldn't have died. They said the same honest, straightforward, unfiltered, no punches pulled statement. If you were here, things would be different, and you weren't here. And yet from Jesus, they get these personalized responses from him amid their grief and how they are in their grief. Why? Why does Jesus give them different responses to the same thing that they've told him? And that in grief, only Jesus as this wonderful counselor can receive your honesty. And the thing that he gives back to you is catered care that you most need. He doesn't say, how dare you talk to me that way? He doesn't say, do you know who you're talking to? He doesn't say, who do you think you are? He doesn't say, hey, here's how you should feel actually. Not this way, but this way. He doesn't say you're too much either. The words to him from the sisters are marked with sadness. If you were here, he wouldn't have died. But the words from the sisters that are said to Jesus are saying this, they're baked into this, is, I can't carry this grief. It's too much for me. Please help me carry it. And he uses both truth to Martha and tears to Mary. He used words to Martha and weeping with Mary. He gives them exactly what they most need to mend where it seems like grief has won their story. We started the service this morning with Psalm 34. In Psalm 34, verse 18, it says, the Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. He's near to the brokenhearted and he saves those who are crushed in spirit. Question, is that true? Like, is he really near to you right now? If you're brokenhearted? When you were, when you will be, is he near to you? And question, will he save those who are crushed in spirit? I mean, like obliterated in spirit? Like your inner world has fallen apart because of the grief that you're bearing? Is he near to you in that? Will he save you from that? As we look to John 11 and apply that idea that he's near to those who are brokenhearted, that he saves those who are crushed in spirit, what kind of honesty can you have if he really is actually near you and he really will save you? What kind of honesty can you have with him? Martha and Mary held no punches as they expressed and laid their grief upon Jesus. And actually, I want to give you permission to do the exact same thing in your grief. Actually, John 11 gives us this picture of saying, Lord, I can't handle my grief. I can't hold my grief. Only you can, and I'm casting it all upon you because you have promised you are near me. And in John 11, actually, we can see there's a promise that when you begin to do that, what will you receive? Maybe truth, maybe tears, but what you will receive is the doctor will order a prescription for you that only the great physician can do. He will give you exactly what you need, just like he did Martha and just like he did Mary. We see here that he'll meet you with the very thing you need where it seems like grief has won your story. Now, if the story ends here, Jesus is a great Enneagram 2. I'm an Enneagram 2. We're winning. This is great. Like, he's empathetic, he's supportive, he's present. He doesn't have to be the hero. But that's not where the story ends. The story ends actually, as we see, we'll unpack. And the story ends in such a way that it changes everything. However you're grieving this morning, however you have grieved, however you will grieve, the story changes because of how the story ends, and really how the story begins. Look at me in verse 38. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, he's deeply kind of snorting again, like he's disturbed and wants to move on this. Deeply moved again, he came to the tomb, and it was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days." And Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you will see the glory of God?" So they took the stone away. And Jesus lifted his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you. You've heard me. I knew you always hear me, but I said this on the account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you have sent me." And when he said these things, he cried out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the man who had died came out, and his hands and his feet bound with linen stripes, and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." That's crazy. Like, he walked up to the tomb, and he'd been dead for 4 days, and there was a stone there, and he said, "Come on, it's time to do this. Let's do it. Take the stone away." And they did it. And the dude walked out. Now, I say that like with levity, also knowing some of you would give your life for this reality to be the reality that you live, so you wouldn't know the grief you're carrying. But what I want to get a hold of, and what Jesus wants to have us grab a hold of this morning as we see this story and apply it to wherever we are right now, is that the ending of John 11 is not the exception. The ending of John 11 is the norm in and with the person of Jesus. That he prayed to his Father as he walked to the tomb. He was moved deeply as he saw the source of what has stolen from his beloved people. And his actions show that the agenda of Jesus is that he will go to the places of death and he will bring life there with simply a word. Which means this: everything in your life, everything good, but certainly everything bad, has to answer to the voice of Jesus. And all of your grief, all of your pain, all of your loss has to answer to the voice of Jesus. And when the voice of Jesus speaks over it, the things that have stolen and things that have died and things that are marked with decay and confusion and loneliness, life will begin to bud and bloom there. Only because the voice of Jesus has come to it, and he's deeply moved in spirit, and he wants to do something about it because he loves you. Everything has to answer the voice of Jesus. In fact, when Jesus goes and calls people out of the grave, they come out and they are unbound, just like Lazarus came out and Lazarus was unbound. But do you know that if you're a Christian, if you follow this person of Jesus, that's your story too? In the New Testament, the book of Romans, Paul writes this crazy reality that you have been raised. Romans 8, verse 11, it says, "If the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, and it is, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of his spirit who lives in you." At the resurrection, hope is actually the tuning fork that everything has to answer to and everything lives by. He doesn't just meet you in your grief. The person of Jesus in John 11 actually undoes death, undoes decay, undoes the thing that has caused you grief. And he brings hope where hopelessness has once reigned. So, as the people of resurrection, here's what I want you to do. This is not an exception. This is the norm you ought to expect. So what does it look like to live out the expectation of the norm? If you're going to say, "Jesus, come bring life where death is in my life right now, where I know grief so well," what does it look like? Well, there's two things. First is this, is that if you're going to live with resurrection hope, you're going to be weird. You're going to be weird. Like, you will not be understood because Jesus is misunderstood in this passage. He goes to the tomb after he's told them, "Your brother's going to rise," and he says, "Take the stone away." And the person that he says to, "Your brother's going to rise," says, "He's dead. Like, that doesn't fit in my category of hope, Jesus. The thing that you're doing and moving, that doesn't make any sense. That's weird. And when Jesus brings us hope to you, and when he brings us hope to other people, it will maybe defy your paradigm and your categories and your expectations. Because if you're going to live with resurrection hope, you're going to live different and weird. And you very well may have more questions than answers as he unfolds, bringing death to life. But secondly, and more importantly, is this: when you live with resurrection hope, you will be free. Because if Lazarus has risen from the dead, and actually the reality is that the Spirit of God who raised him, Jesus, from the dead is in you, and it is, you will be free. Did Lazarus go back into the tomb? Lazarus walked out and was unbound and began to know a new freedom that he did not know days prior. So if you're going to live with resurrection hope, you will live free, because actually everything that death has taken from you and decay has taken from you and grief has taken from you, resurrection would say this: I will give back to you 100-fold. And all this is because the same Jesus that calls Lazarus out of the tomb and unbinds Lazarus will be the same Jesus that actually will be bound up himself and walk into the tomb for you and I. And actually, the story of John 11 tells us this story: that in your waiting, you are loved. As you're holding your grief and you're waiting for Jesus to move, know this: you are loved. And in John 11, we know the story of this. In your grief, you are comforted in a way that's calculated and catered to your very wounds. That he sits with you. And the beautiful story is this: the scandal of the gospel is that where death is, resurrection will be brought by Jesus in a way that we could never asked, hoped, or even imagined. Because the story of John 11 is our story. Let me pray for us. Lord, I pray that you would do something only you can do, which is comfort the disturbed. Those who are marked with grief and pain and loss, would you bring comfort, just like you promised in this passage? And Lord, also, you ask us to live fully, which means we have to hold our grief as you're holding us. And we give it over to you. So Lord, do only you can do, which is disturb the comfortable. I pray, Lord, that we would, in such a way that the scandal and the craziness of this story, it just feels like a fairy tale. And so, Lord, I pray that instead of seeing this as there's no way, would we begin to actually just give airtime to the question of what if it's true? And if it's true, Lord, it changes everything. So by the power of your Spirit, give us a redemptive imagination that says and looks at the things of death and decay and loss and grief in our life, and give us an imagination to say, what if the Jesus of John 11 met this? Journey towards us in our fourth day of hopelessness, and give us hope, we pray. Amen.